everyone. Welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now, we got a good one for you this week, as my colleague Mike Neff will join me to discuss an interesting race weekend at Pocono Raceway, which saw Denny Hamlin claim his third Cup Series victory of the season. We'll also chat about the post-race chaos between Kurt Busch and Ricky Stenhouse Jr., which trickled over to Twitter on Monday, as well as Dos Amigos, Daniel Suarez and Bubba Wallace having a little scuffle after the race. And oh yeah, Jimmy Johnson's got a new crew chief going forward in Cliff Daniels. And also, Alex Bowman stopped by with me on Saturday at Pocono to discuss his 2019 season, how his win at Chicago validated his career, and of course, we got to talk about some dogs. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on Apple Podcasts, as it helps us out tremendously. Now let's talk Pocono with Neff. All right, Neff, I feel like we got a lot to talk about this week. Fun Pocono race, maybe I'm saying that because I was there. Truck race, not so much. But we were talking offline, and, you know, it was definitely better than the June Pocono race, where it was just like a single-line Memorial Day parade kind of deal. But this week, we actually had some passing. Kyle Larson came from the back and charged to the front. He got a top-five finish. But Denny Hamlin, with some strategy there at the end, got by Eric Jones and cruised the victory after some late race restarts. But what do you feel about the race as a whole?
I thought it was an okay race. I mean, as Pocono races go, it was an average to slightly above average Pocono race, I thought. I think the PJ1 makes a difference. It throws some different options at them. It gives guys the abilities, again, to kind of to move around. I was intrigued that Kyle Busch kind of went up high early, and it didn't seem like that was a way to go, but I think it benefited him in the long run, and I think it kind of got the sticky stuff activated a little earlier in the race than it might have been if everybody would have stayed on the bottom. So I was intrigued by that. Again, the racing in the pack was interesting, but again, at the front, it's terrible, and I think it's going to be that way until we get these cars off the ground. But as I said, it was an interesting strategy call. We did have fuel come into it, as we almost always do at Pocono. I'm highly intrigued for next year. This doubleheader thing is going to be really neat. But
sure,
if I'm giving a grade, I'll give them a B.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was about an average race, and if we're grading the package this year, I would say B minus, C plus maybe. So I feel like the race fit right in. I do think the late race restarts, we had two of them, of course, helped maybe sway that opinion. But as you said, like the traction compound, it seems like it's helped out tracks like a Pocono. I mean, this is, you know, the first time they've really utilized it, but a Loudon last week and also last year. We were talking offline again, and artificial substances, I mean, if it creates for better racing, then why not use it? And I mean, that's what the tracks are going for. I saw Kyle Larson every lap. He was charging to the front early on. And sure, a lot of that was passing some of the cars that are underfunded and running the back weekly. But, you know, once he got to the top 20, I mean, he still kept going, and he was using the traction compound off of three, and then he would dive low. It's almost like he was diamond in the corner at Pocono, yeah, which we don't really see a whole ton of. So, yes, it was a track position race. We only saw two passes for the lead, green flag passes that weren't up for pit stops. So I thought it was an average race, too. But I thought it was a hell of
On the traction compound side, I would rather see tires, mm-hmm, you know, maybe a little different and have that be where we gain and lose grip. But I was very anti-sticky stuff early on because I feel like it has hurt drag racing, and that's where it comes from. But now they can't really even go out and race unless they have a bunch of track prep that goes on, and I don't want us to get to that point. But if we use it sparingly in kind of the way that they have so far, then I'm kind of coming around on it a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. But it does concern me that, you know, Kevin Harvick was leading. He led the most laps on Sunday, 62 of them. And I feel like it was Ryan Blaney he caught. I think Ryan Blaney had just pitted. Ryan Blaney had a day. He came back to finish 10th, but he had quite a day. So Harvick was catching him, and he just couldn't do anything with him. And it's not that, you know, Blaney was already in the fence, or, you know, something happened where Blaney was, he could hold Harvick off, and I feel like if you're the leader, you shouldn't be able to, you know, you should be able to make passes on traffic, especially when you're having a rough day like Blaney was. And I don't think he had fresh tires at the time. Same thing with Keselowski. Keselowski got in the wall early, lap four, talked to him about it after the race, and he just said it was because of dirty air from the 41, which is Daniel Suarez. But, you know, that dirty air put him in the wall. He had to come and take right side tires, but he came out right in front of Harvick. And Harvick couldn't do anything with him. And Harvick had the fastest car at times. So that just shows you that it's hard to pass. But it looked like back in the pack, you could pass.
Agreed. Yeah, I think you it's been that way all year. I mean, it's in the pack. You're passing, but still. And Pocono's one of those places where you expect it a little bit more, where you make that long run down the front stretch and you can slingshot by guys. And we saw it some, but it was still predominantly side drafting.
Right.
And I still think that this package, that's where you get your advantage from. And it's, as far as I know, that wasn't what we were going for. I thought we were going for trying to have cars be able to make runs and make passes based on speed. And it's a completely arrow passing deal.
For sure. And, you know, you brought up fuel mileage. It was a fuel kind of mileage race there at the end until we had a couple cautions. But even then, if we had another restart, another caution, another, it would have been like five laps under, you know, 168 laps instead of 163 that it ended up being. A lot of drivers were going to run out, if not having to come in.
Really exciting.
If
we'd have had another caution there, you'd have had probably 15 to 18 guys run out of gas.
But even still, like, I thought, you know, I was on the edge of my seat. I thought it was exciting. A lot of people don't like fuel mileage races, or, you know, they don't come a whole ton. At Pocono, they do, because, you know, a lot of people want to pit as soon as the fuel window opens. And we saw this week that the fuel window was increased by, like, four or five laps. And I forget who it was, but they asked Denny Hamlin after the race in the post-race media conference, why is that? Why was it 36 to 40 laps when in the past used to be, like, 30 to 35? And that's strictly because they have less horsepower this year. So
yeah, you're not using as much fuel.
Exactly.
Fuel makes horsepower.
Exactly. So
I did want to make one other comment for Josh Balicki. He got roasted on social media for that late race caution.
I saw that, yeah.
And thankfully, they did show a picture of the drive shaft. But if you've ever had a drive shaft come apart, and I have not been in a vehicle. Well, I've been in a truck that the drive shaft broke loose, so that made enough noise. But I've seen the aftermath of a drive shaft in a race car, and it destroys a car. I mean, well, hell, we saw Bowman go to a backup at Loudon because of it. So I don't blame Balicki for getting on the brakes and stopping when he did. And yes, it looked questionable for sure, but there is no doubt that he broke the drive shaft, and that was a 100% legit caution.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So this is kind of funny. So before the race, I'm walking down pit road and I have a tap on the shoulder and it's Josh Balicki. And he's like, hey man, what's up, whatever. And I asked him, you know, are you guys going to start at the back? Because remember the tech inspection, like 8 or 10 cars failed. And we see a lot of times that drivers go to the back or underfunded teams go to the back just so they're not in the way. And he says, yeah, you know, we always go to the back because if not, we kind of feel like it's disrespectful. So Josh isn't going to go out there and just park the car because he has to, you know. He parked it because he felt unsafe in it, I'm sure. So, yeah, Brad Keselowski, I was one of the only two people that talked to him post-race, and he wasn't very happy. I think they did hash it out on Twitter afterwards and got everything clear, obviously, like you said, with the picture. That was a scary deal, I'm sure. I've never had a drive shaft go bad, but probably don't want to either.
Yeah, that's absolutely 100%, especially when you're doing 150, 170 miles an hour and it starts thrashing around in there. It sounds like it's coming through the floor, which again is another reason they have reinforced those tunnels under the car so it doesn't come up into the driver compartment. So also, you mentioned tech inspection. Man, it started to bother me that race day has become a 3-hour Twitter watch about tech inspection before we ever get to racing.
Agreed.
It's ridiculous that it's like, you know, we're literally getting play-by-play live tweet updates on who has passed tech. And It just, it's ridiculous.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, since this optical system or the OSS or whatever it's called came into play last year, the Hawkeye system, we've seen a lot of failures in tech, and it seems more so than normal, especially this year, because, I mean, the cards are almost identical I mean, we see, like, the RCR guys fail a lot, right? Like, Austin Dillon failed 2 or 3 times the other day. So, yeah, I agree. It's not fun to cover it either. We have to. But you're just standing there, and you're waiting to see if they got the clear. If an official goes with them, with the team, once the car goes, rolls through inspection, they're good, because they can't work on it anymore. So that's why the official goes with them.
Right.
Not fun, but, you know, we did see a lot of guys from the that did foul come towards the front. Like Austin Dillon, he fouled twice, but I know he finished 19th, which isn't, you know, sexy or anything, but he was running top 5-6 there at the end. But Neff, Denny Hamlin got the victory, as we said earlier. Made a pass on Eric Jones late as Jones was saving fuel. Hamlin said after the race that he thought he knew that he'd saved enough fuel at that point, and that's why he was charging hard. Hamlin's third win of the year, finished second the week prior in New Hampshire. Neff, this 11 team is kind of sneakily, very good this year.
Sneakily, yes. I would say your Daytona 500 winner is pretty good. Again, we got spoiled there for a little while in the sport when crew chief changes would be made and dudes would immediately, like, come out winning and just hit the ground running. And it used to be that when you changed a crew chief, you had a solid 6 months to a year of racing before you really kind of gelled. And, you know, Hamlin did that this year. They switched up from Wheeler to Gabehart, and, you know, they came out of the box, won the 500, and then they kind of slid off a little bit. And I think it was just a matter of those two really kind of figuring the communication and the feel out for all these different tracks. And now that they've kind of been through the wars and we're starting to go back to tracks for a second time, I really feel like they're gonna kind of ramp up that little extra bit, and I think you're gonna see them and Kyle be the flagship or flag bearers for Joe Gibbs Racing instead of it being the 18 and everybody else.
I would add Truex in there too, because they still got 4 wins, and I know they've been inconsistent lately, but finished third the other day. But yeah, I mean, you said, you know, you noticed on how Chris Gabehart, rookie crew chief at the Cup level, they did get off to a good start this year until Talladega came around. Then they had 4 finishes outside the top 15, a 6th at Pocono, the first Pocono. And then since then, it's kind of been consistent. Chicago, they finished outside the top 10. Daytona happened. But now they got 3 straight top 5s.
Daytona happened. Other way you phrase that.
Now they have 3 straight top 5s. They're going to Watkins Glen this week, obviously. And Hamlin won there 3 years ago, 2016. He's had a lot of mixed results there over the past decade or so. So, I don't know, Neff. I feel like they're improving, definitely, as the year's gone on. And he's already got 10 top 5s this year, which matches the total from last year. So, yeah, I mean, right now, I feel like I would put him in the championship 4, because also we know that the playoff tracks line up pretty well for him.
Absolutely. And again, we talked about it last year for most of the regular season that we thought we were going to see 3, maybe 4 cars from Stewart Haas in the final 4. It's absolutely lining up where we could very easily see 3, if not 4 cars from Joe Gibbs Racing in the final 4.
Yeah, and if they don't get at least 2, I would say it's a big disappointment this year, even if they win the championship.
Agreed.
Because that's how strong they are this year. They have, 11 wins? Yeah, they have 11 of the 21 wins this year. Denny told me at the first Pocono race I got to interview that he would like the team to win 40%. He'd be like, that'd be a good number. So that's roughly 16 races, so they got 5 more to go. Definitely think they'll hit that, especially when you have Eric Jones, Neff, who's been on a little bit of a hot streak. 3 straight top 3 finishes, fighting for his job for sure, as we've talked about on this podcast, and I think he knows that too. Post-race in the winner's press conference, Coach Gibbs it didn't seem like he was very committal to Jones, and, you know, he said there's a lot of relationships that are put to the test, there's a lot of sponsors that need to be happy, and I don't know. I thought like 3 months ago when Jones says they were first in the negotiations that they were going to have a signed deal for next year, but it kind of seems like maybe not because he was asked again this week and he had no update. So, I mean, he's fighting for his life, and for whatever reason, the last 3 years since he's come to Cup, Jones is really good in the summer months. I mean, we got Bristol coming up. Watkins Glen, he had a top five last year. He's just really consistent once summer rolls around.
Yeah, it was not a glowing endorsement from the coach to make him feel warm and fuzzy that he's secure in his position by any stretch. So, yeah, I agree. He knows he's fighting for it. I still feel like when it's all said and done, they're going to do something with Levine.
I do too.
To end up putting either Jones or Bell in a second car for Levine. But you never know. I mean, I would hate to see Matt DiBenedetto lose his job just because Toyota wants to keep Erik Jones in the fold, but they want to put Christopher Bell in a JGR car. So I hope that if we come down to that where they need another car, they will fund another car rather than booting Matty D out of a ride, because he's done amazing things this year. I think he's proven he deserves it. But at the same time, as you said, Erik Jones has been running really well.
Yeah.
And a win is coming. So I don't think there's any doubt that he's going to – well, I shouldn't say no doubt. It will be surprising if he doesn't have a win by the time the playoffs get here. And if that's enough to secure his job, who knows? Because, unfortunately, we're limited. I still keep wondering if NASCAR is going to change this four-team rule or four-car per team rule sometime soon, because we're at the point now where charters are charters and we're not really getting a bunch of other cars. So whether the 36 come from 9 teams or 12 teams doesn't really matter. And I don't know that getting a fifth JGR team would necessarily be a bad thing.
And I feel like that's exactly what's going to happen. I feel like you hit it spot on the head. I think there will be two cars at LFR. It's up to what the manufacturer wants. I mean, we talk about sponsorships in all this, right? And sponsorships obviously run the sport. Money, you know, wins. But the biggest supplier of money is the manufacturers. So
yep.
It's going to be whatever they want. Erik Jones is a very talented race car driver, as is obviously Christopher Bell, as is Matt DiBenedetto. I don't know if you saw the quotes, Neff, but over the weekend, Matt DiBenedetto had not a press conference, but one of the media gathering things. And he said, I'm going to paraphrase this, but he said something to the like of, you'd have to get your head examined to kick me out of this car, because no one's going to do as good as this car as I can. That's a lot of confidence. And I like that coming from Matt DiBenedetto, because he's, you know, for so long, he's embraced the underdog role. His story's a great story. He was just on the podcast last week telling us about it. So that team's made a ton of improvements, finished 17th on Sunday, but had a top 12, 15 car. Just strategy kind of bit him at the end. So, it'd be tough, but Erik Jones definitely fighting for his life to put this full circle.
Absolutely. And like I said, I still think a win's coming. I don't know if a win keeps his job. That would be the even more interesting thing. What happens if we get all the way to Homestead and all four JGR guys are there, and then Christopher Bell is already signed to be in a JGR car next year? What kind of a discussion will that be if you've got Jones, knowing he's out of a ride, running for a championship for JGR? That would be a great storyline.
Would be a good storyline. But there's still three and a half months until Homestead and a lot of season to go. So
a lot of crap's going to go on between now and then.
For sure. Silly season's definitely approaching, if not here. So I would definitely expect to see something coming here soon on that whole dilemma. But Neff, you know, you had Truex finished third, William Byron fourth, Kyle Larson made it to fifth. Good top 10 run for Daniel Hemric. I think he definitely needed that. But I want to go down the field a little bit, because fast forward to the late race restarts, and we had a little dust up between Kurt Busch and Ricky Stenhouse that triggered over to Twitter on Monday, which Kurt Busch's tweet was one of the funniest tweets I've seen in a long time. How he's going to take the high road and hope that Stenhouse doesn't wreck him up there too.
Yeah.
So what happened is, you know, Stenhouse got put in the wall. Kurt got put into Stenhouse, which put Stenhouse into the wall. And then Stenhouse just dumped Kurt, What's your take on all this? Because I found it comical on Twitter, but obviously a serious matter on the track.
I think your biggest problem there out of that whole thing, and you know, I don't like to dump on the spotters because their job's definitely not easy, especially off of turn two at Pocono. But I felt like the spotter needed to be on the radio as soon as it happened, letting Stenhouse know that it wasn't Kurt's fault. And I don't think that happened. And I think that's why Stenhouse ended up wrecking him. Because if you're Stenhouse, you're coming out of the corner on the high side, Kurt basically comes up and pancakes you into the wall. You don't realize that the guy underneath Kurt actually drove him up into you. So in your view, which you don't even really have a view because you got a head restraint on your left to barely even know what car it was till he went by you after he hit you, he's had no idea that there was somebody below Kurt. And if I was in that situation, I would have probably done the same thing. My race has pretty much been ruined because you ran me into the wall. I'm going to wreck you to make sure you don't get to have a good result either. And so I understood the logic of it. At the same time, post-race, there should have been, I think, some communication either from spotters to drivers or crew chief to drivers to let them know, especially Ricky, what actually happened. And then, you know, at that point, it's up to him to reach out to Kurt or Kurt to reach out to him. If they choose not to do that, that's on them, and how they handle it from here is fine. If they both can look at the video and realize what happened and move on from it, okay. But I promise you, Kurt Busch does not forget. And you heard that at Daytona when the whole lightning thing happened. And Kurt immediately gets on radio. He's like, they took one from me in 2014 as well. You know? I mean, he doesn't forget. And I promise you, at some point in his life, whether it's at some, you know, all-star gathering 20 years from now where they have some old-timers running around in Legends cars or something, he's going to wreck Jimmy Johnson because he's still angry at Jimmy Johnson from Pocono like 6 years ago. So Kirk could say he's taking a high road. I promise you at some point, unless they work this thing out, he's going to dump Stenhouse as retaliation.
Yeah, and we're going to Watkins Glen this week where Kurt runs well, and Stenhouse has always struggled on road courses, but you never know. It's a shorter track, and then we got Bristol coming up, which they're both very good at Bristol, as we noted with Stenhouse last week. But yeah, the quote said, Kurt's quote, his Twitter said, "After sleeping on it, I've decided to take the high road with Stenhouse incident. Hopefully he won't wreck me up there as well." Only for Stenhouse to counter and say, "Take the road on over if you really want to handle it. You have my number." So, I mean, Twitter's been, it can be a nasty place, but, you know, I kind of like seeing it in the public sphere like this, to a degree. And then I feel like they should handle things privately or on pit road, bring back fighting, do whatever you want. But I don't know, if I was Kurt, I wouldn't mess with Stenhouse. From a physical aspect, I should say.
Yeah, I think that would be a pretty even foul fight, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I know
Stenhouse a little bit smaller than Kurt is.
Yeah, Stenhouse is CrossFit though, so it'd be interesting.
He's country strong.
For sure, you know,
being a farmer and all. So yeah, I think that'd be a pretty good bout. But I'm torn on the Twitter thing. I actually kind of like that they're settling it out on Twitter because the rest of the fan base actually gets to see it play out.
Right.
And that kind of is a thing that we get to look into that we don't normally get to see. So that part of it's kind of cool. But if they turn into whiny little bitches and don't settle it and just act foolish, then I don't like it. So, I mean, if they settle it out like adults, then I'm down with it. But if they get petty about it and it turns into some kind of garbage, then yeah, let's settle it like men and not worry about it.
And the end result was Stenhouse finishing 21st and Kurt Busch 27th. Kurt had a ton of damage to the car.
Yeah.
And then the worst case was for Michael McDowell, who was an innocent bystander. and then got wrecked, put in the wall, finished 25th. So tough deal for that team. They've had a lot of bad luck this year. But Neff, we had another incident too. Pocono brought out the fire in everybody. You had two friends going at it after the race, Bubba Wallace and Daniel Suarez. So Jordan Bianchi of The Athletic, he went down to actually see if there's going to be something going on between Stenhouse and Kurt. But it turns out on the way, Bubba Wallace and Daniel Suarez were in a shouting match over Bubba giving Suarez the finger on the track on the white flag, or I think it was the white flag. And then Bubba, you know, you can't really hear what was going on in the video or what was being said. But I could hear that Wallace was saying, you know, I give everyone the finger. And Suarez, go back, you know, tie this back into social media. On NASCAR's Instagram page, they kind of tagged him in it. And Suarez goes, where I come from, those are fighting words or something to that effect. So if that was the case, there'd be a lot of fights in NASCAR weekly.
Oh, God, yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I kind of like the way they settled it out. At least the way I looked at it, when it was all said and done and they parted ways, I thought everybody was okay. It seemed like everybody was smiling and we'd all worked it out. Unlike Harrison Burton and Paul Menard last week when, you know, if looks could kill, they both probably would have been dead. but it's, I agree with you 100%. If flipping people off started fights, every driver in the garage would be fighting at the end of every race. I didn't see the actual incident, but when you're racing hard with, you know, a couple laps to go, we're in overtime, you're getting everything you can, feathers are going to get ruffled a little bit. And as long as, you know, as long as cooler heads prevail and we work it out, that's fine. If we want to throw down and it's just the drivers, I'm fine with that too. I've always maintained that the driver fights should be handled like hockey fights. And you let the two of them go at it. As soon as somebody hits the ground, it's over. And I think if we did that on a regular basis, we would not see cars getting torn up like we did this weekend. So hopefully they all worked that out. It seemed like they did. Bubba was back on Twitter on Tuesday giving away pizza. And Monday, I think he was checking out. He got some new headphones or something. So he had an active time on social media this weekend. But it didn't seem like there were any lingering ill effects. So I think it was, unlike some of the other hostilities, I thought that one worked out pretty smoothly.
Yeah, I agree. And these guys have raced each other for a long time. Like, they started pretty much together back in K&N. So I think Bubba's tweets after the race said, you know, family fights or something to that effect. So these two are good friends, it seems like. But, you know, I feel like that all stemmed from, because Suarez finished 24th, and he had a top, I don't know, eight to 10 car in practice for sure, led one of the practices. But I feel like that all stemmed from maybe a little bit of frustration from Suarez. Not only that he had a bad run, because he wasn't really in the top 10 all day, was a non-factor, but also the fact that he had the restart violation, which NASCAR, you know, told people in the driver's meeting Saturday and Sunday for the truck and cup race, and I'm sure the Xfinity race in Iowa, that if you're going to lag back, they're going to call it. And Suarez lagged back, got a huge run, passed a lot of cars on the second to last restart, and, you know, he ultimately got black flagged for it and had to serve a penalty.
Yeah, I mean, there was no doubt about it, and everybody heard it, that you couldn't lag back. And when they showed the replay, I mean, he was at least a car length and a half back. You could almost fit two cars in between him and a car in front. And they're not going to put up with that, especially with this reduced horsepower package, because getting that run on a restart is just a huge benefit compared to running, you know, trying to chase somebody down. So I could see where it was angry. And again, that puts you back there with the squirrels. And if you're back there running with the squirrels, things get a little nuts. So I don't blame him for being a little hostile. But again, I appreciate the fact. And Suarez, I like that, is one of those guys that if he's got a problem, he's going to come talk to you. Yeah. Ask Michael McDowell about that.
Dropped him.
He will come let you know, and if you don't like your answer, we'll settle it. So I like him. I like his straightforward attitude. He is a no-holds-barred kind of guy.
I totally agree with that on Suarez. I mean, he dropped McDowell, and McDowell's a pretty big guy at Phoenix earlier this year. So I wouldn't mess with Suarez. Now, Neff, we got another, you know, big news on Monday on Twitter that I saw this originally. Jimmy Johnson and Cliff Daniels. So Cliff Daniels taking over kerchief role for Jimmy Johnson. Johnson's relationship with Kevin Meandering only lasted 21 races after Chad Knaus had worked with him for the past decade and a half or whatever. So this is a big move, and it's kind of like a Hail Mary, I feel like, to a degree. Even though Johnson got a stage victory, albeit by strategy, on Sunday at Pocono. But it was only his second ever stage victory, which is kind of crazy to think after how much success he's had throughout his career. He's got more championships and stage victories. But in 2.5 years now of stages. So, like I said, I feel like this is a Hail Mary. Cliff Daniels has had some success, never crew chiefed, but he worked with Chad Knaus very closely in the past. You like this move? And do you feel like it was necessary?
I mean, I don't know if I can say that it's necessary because I don't know the inner workings of what's going on there. I honestly was a little bit surprised. I mean, to not even give Meandering a whole year just seemed a bit abrupt. But I kind of get the feeling that there obviously was serious tension going on there, enough for Hendrick to pull the trigger on the move. So it makes me feel like there was a serious difference of opinion, and obviously, I mean, obviously both sides agreed to this. So I feel like everybody involved kind of realized that this was not working out and it was the best move for everybody to move on. But at the same time, it's interesting to me that you're taking a rookie crew chief and putting him on with Johnson when he's obviously getting to the end of his career. And I mean, I guess it's hard to say. It's good and bad, because I think a rookie crew chief is coming to this without preconceived notions. So he may be able to actually give a fresh look at this and help Johnson to migrate to the newer form of the cars between no ride height rules and this new package, which has seriously been his downfall. I mean, since we've gone to the no ride height rule, Jimmy Johnson has struggled. And maybe it's a whole new fresh look that's going to be what takes him back up to victory lane.
Yeah, you bring up a lot of good points. I'm kind of thinking it wasn't mutual, though. I feel like this is more of a Johnson decision because, you know, yes, he only had one crew chief at the cup level, being Chad Knaus, and they had obviously so much success. And then Chad goes over and helps William Byron. Compared to last year, it's night and day. He got a second top five run of the year this past week, but they're qualifying better, they're running better, and compared to Johnson, I mean, Johnson's right now, you could argue that Chase is the worst car at Hendrick, only because the past month, 2 months have been terrible for them, but they haven't been much better for Johnson. But like I said, I feel like this is a Hail Mary, because even though he got the stage win, Johnson's on the outside of the playoffs right now, and I said last week I thought that he would miss the playoffs. I'm kind of right there on the borderline. It's going to be him or Newman, I think, that fall, either get in, one gets in, one gets out. And obviously, you know, you have Newman and Bowyer both 12 points ahead of Johnson. We have some good tracks coming up for Johnson, but we also have some good tracks coming up for Bowyer and Newman. So it'll be interesting. It's going to come right down to the wire, I feel like, because I just don't see a ton of speed out of the 48. And now you're with five races to go. I mean, these are really important races for that 48 team, because right now they're out.
I agree. That's why I was shocked. I mean, it just, the timing of it's kind of weird, and I don't know. I feel like it wasn't mutual, because remember the milk and cookies meeting back in the day, and at that time, I don't remember which one of the two it was that really wanted to lose the other one, but It was not a mutual thing, and so they worked it out. This time, having it be this timing and this abrupt makes me feel like it was a deal where they both realized it just wasn't going to work.
It's interesting, though, because prior to working with Johnson, Kevin Meandering spent 3 years at Junior Motorsports working with Elliott Sadler. And Elliott Sadler is very vocal in how he felt about Kevin Meandering. Even Brett Griffin, the spotter for Elliott Sadler, and Clint Boyer at the Cup level, said how, you know, how much of an impact that Meandering had on Elliott. Elliott said that he rejuvenated his career. And, you know, those are the last 3 years of his full-time of his career. So he had 3 wins in 2016 with Meandering. And he had, obviously, you know, the level at the Cup level is a lot more advanced, especially once you get outside the top 15 in the Xfinity Series. But he had 28 top 10s the first year, 25 in 17, and then 24 in 2018. No fewer than 12 top fives each year, and those 3 wins in 2016, like I mentioned. But I don't know. I feel like you're giving up on Meandering. Where does he go from here?
Yeah, I don't know if he... I mean, he'll be reassigned in the organization. I don't know if he ends up going over to where, you know, the kind of role that that Daniels was in, because Daniels had come off the road and was in a different role. So, I mean, there's hundreds of employees at Hendrick, so I'm sure they'll figure out someplace where they can use him, no doubt about that, because he's a really sharp mind. They're not going to let him go, but who knows? Maybe he slides back over to General Motorsport.
Could be. I mean, but even then, you know, they're having good runs this year with some of the inexperience they have, whether it be with Noah Gragson being a rookie, and he's got a great crew chief in David Elms, and then you got the 8 car that's got 9 drivers in it, and I think Taylor Moyer's doing a hell of a job as a crew chief in that car, adapting to 9 different driving styles. That's kind of unheard of for a big team like Junior Motorsports, but... Yeah, interesting stuff at the 48 camp in Hendrick Motorsports this week. I was caught off guard by it. I didn't see it coming. So, hey, well, they're going to a road course, so that'll test them out right away.
Absolutely, yeah. You want to throw a rookie crew chief into the fire, have his first race be at a road course in a couple of
them. Yeah, I'm sure Jimmy will be, you know, pretty influential on the strategy this week and how that plays out. But like we said, Cliff, you know, he might be a rookie at the Cup level or as a crew chief in general. But he does have experience working with Knaus, so who knows? Maybe they'll get a victory this weekend, a place Johnson's never won at.
That would be a story.
Neff, any final thoughts on the Cup race before we kind of move on? Because we got a lot of topics to discuss.
I'm still a fan of Pocono. I know a lot of people don't like it, and the sentiments about it being boring or whatever. But I like that it taxes the teams and you have to make compromise. You can never get a car that works great at all 3 corners. And I like the uniqueness of it. I hope they don't ever take it away or change it.
I agree. I've been going to Pocono since I was 8 years old. So I'm a big fan of Pocono. Let's quickly talk about the doubleheader next week because they came out with this schedule. I feel like this is a good place for it. So it looks like it's going to be 2 350-mile races, 1 Saturday, 1 on Sunday. The Sunday is definitely 350 miles. The 350 on Saturday is tentative. But you also have an Xfinity race on Sunday morning, a truck race on Saturday morning. Friday is pretty much an entire practice day. Thursday's ARCA. That's a busy schedule. And it could, if you know, it rains up here in the Northeast, so it could be the speed weeks of Pocono next week, or next year, I should say. Should we get any weather, but what are your thoughts on this? Because, you know, we talked about this when the schedule came out. I thought it was a really good idea. Pocono as a whole, I think they needed something. It's a family-run track by the Igdalskis. Always has been for a long time. So I feel like, you know, it's something new and maybe something to keep 2 races at the track. And should it work, I think we might see other tracks do it.
Yeah, I think this is a definite trial balloon. And if it works out, I think we will see it at probably 3 or 4 races or 3 or 4 tracks in the future if it works out. I think it's awesome. I think it's going to be a truly action-packed weekend, and fans are going to be able to get a lot of bang for their buck, especially camping fans that camp at infield. I do worry about the weather because, as you said, it rains in Pocono a lot. And I would be very intrigued if Saturday gets rained out. Do they try to run them both on Sunday, or do you immediately postpone one of them to Monday?
I think you'd have to postpone one to Monday. They have. I mean,
I think it would be amazing if they went, okay, we're going to have to race twice on Sunday, so the first race is going to start at like 9 a.m.
Well, the only worry I have with that is not only do you have a cup race, you also have a truck race you got to run on Saturday. So if that were to get rained out, I mean...
But a truck race is like 12 laps.
Well, they're going to move it. They're going to move it to
the first race. Then you run the truck race, and that lets the cup teams go through their cars and get it ready. And you're basically Saturday night racing with twin features is what you got.
Yeah.
Your late model teams running twin features, so they get an hour and a half or so between their first feature and their second feature to tweak their car. And I think it would be kind of cool if it ends up at that. But I'm with you. I doubt they would do that. I have to believe if Saturday gets rained out, they'll push one of the races to Monday. But who knows?
Well,
it'd be really fun to watch if they did it.
Yeah, that question was asked, and they had no. They didn't have an answer. between Ben May, the track president, Nick Ladolski, and Scott Miller was there. For NASCAR, they didn't have an answer because, I mean, essentially this is still 11 months away this weekend. So,
and we ignore rain all the time with NASCAR.
Yeah, until NASCAR's in town, and then it's gonna bite you in the ass probably. So, I mean, the only problem with that is they're extending the truck race, thankfully, because it's only 150 miles currently, but they're extending to 200 miles, so it'll be 80 laps. Xfinity race is 225 miles, I believe, and then maybe 250. And then you got, you know, 250s. I mean, that's a lot of racing in one day. So I think they definitely have to move one to Monday. But I give credit to Pocono. I think it keeps them relevant, and also it's a big trial and error. If it works, I think other tracks will do it to keep two dates, essentially, two races on the schedule.
Sure, and I think it gives us an opportunity to either expand the schedule or give us a couple extra off weekends.
Right.
And I think off weekends would be welcomed, or shortening up the schedule, which I like where the schedule ends.
I do too.
I don't like all these people are like, we don't want to go up against football, so we want it to stop in September. Because I enjoy football, but I'm a racing guy. And I don't want my racing, because local short track racing, when you get to September, slows way down.
Right.
You have some big events, that's when your big event season comes. But individual tracks slow or stop when you get to September. And so the only racing we've still got is cup racing. You get to the end of November, and then you have the snowball, and you're getting ready for the Chili Bowl, and then the next year starts. But it's just... I like having that run all the way up till Thanksgiving, and I really will be bummed if the result of these doubleheaders is we start wrapping up the season sometime in early October.
Yeah, no, I 100% there with you, and we're already ending it a week early next year because of the two Pocono races being the same weekend. So
I kind of like that because it's purely selfish, but the Myrtle Beach 400 was always on Homestead weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could never get cup drivers to come run because they were always in Homestead. Now, hopefully, we'll be able to get two or three of the cup guys to spend their first off weekend right before Thanksgiving at the Myrtle Beach 400, because I think it'd be an awesome race.
I think we'll get some down there next year for sure. Let's quickly talk about the truck race now, because not a whole lot happened. Ross Chastain dominated. I think he's a championship favorite. Kind of crazy to think that he believes he's not the championship favorite. He said that in the press conference after the race because of how, you know, small the team is, how few employees they have. Yet they've won three races this year and have crossed the finish line first four times. In this race, you had Stuart Friesen crash out in the first lap, which was big, because then you had drivers like Harrison Burton, even Matt Crafton and Ben Rhodes, all points racing. And obviously we're going to Eldora, so we'll make our predictions later. But now we got a points battle after Friesen's been in the top two in points all year. Now I think he fell to fourth, and he's only 13 points above Burton.
Yeah, that threw a big monkey wrench into the points. And I couldn't believe it, in all honesty. And I'm pretty sure Stewart couldn't either.
He was dejected. He was miserable.
I mean, it's the vagaries of Pocono and the trucks. But, man, you get down in there with somebody on your outside, it's easy for those things to turn around on cold tires. And to see, I mean, it doesn't kill the whole season, but it makes your work a lot tougher over the next few weeks. I still feel like Friesen's a big favorite at Eldora, but at the same time, he may not be. And we'll have to see how it plays out. But, I think I'm with you. I think Chastain, from a pragmatic standpoint, is not a favorite because, like you said, they have whatever they've got, 8 full-time employees or something. But they've proven that they can put race-winning trucks on the track, and he has absolutely proven he's a race-winning driver. So put those two things together. I still feel like Johnny Sauter is going to get things back together here. He's had a real lull the last 4 or 5 races.
Yeah, ever since he won.
And I feel like he's one of those guys that could get to the playoffs and get on a roll and just run away. But I'm not counting Chastain out until the checkered flies at Homestead because he is on fire right now.
And plus he's building up all these playoff points too because he's winning stages and winning the race. So a very good story there in Ross Chastain. As we know, I think it's probably, you could argue this, but I feel like it might be the best story of the year. And his last year. Last year was one of the best stories, too, with how he went to Ganassi, and obviously that ended badly with DC Solar, but with how that transpired and how he's busted his ass for the past 5 or 6 years running, and still does at the cup level, running, you know, not the best equipment. And, I mean, you could even argue the truck. The truck's not the best equipment. Yes, they're getting their trucks from GMS, but yes, they only have 8 or 10 employees. Like, he said this post-race that they drove to the track from Charlotte because they don't want to waste money on a plane ticket, was his exact words. So I know they also, you know, once Ross left Pocono on Sunday, he went to do the Protect Your Melon, or, you know, the Melon campaign with the New York safety government here in New York at Watkins Glen, and did some presentations. And then he drove or took a bus to Eldora today. So, I mean, this guy works his ass off to have the opportunities that he has, and now it's coming kind of full fruition, kind of a full circle deal. So cool to see Chastain, and obviously he's been very good at the podcast. So, 3 wins this year. Good stuff for Ross Chastain.
Absolutely.
Now, Neff, moving on to the Xfinity race. I thought we had a good race. It was the Christopher Bell show for a while until the end. He had 234 of the first 243 laps. But then Chase Briscoe got by with some 4 fresh tires. There's really good battling at the end of this race between Briscoe and John Hunter, and then John Hunter and Christopher Bell, and then ultimately Chase Briscoe and Christopher Bell. So, I mean, I thought this was a really good race, and Chase got his first win of the year and broke through for Stuart Haas.
It is interesting because you look at driver development programs, and I don't know if Chevy has one at all. If they do, it's not much.
They got the Driver Edge one with GMS and Junior Motorsports. But outside of that, yeah, not much.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like Chevy is dumping money into it.
Right.
Ford has some and is really giving Chase a lot of sim time and putting him in different situations to go race and develop as a driver. And I think that is paying off. We're seeing that start to have real fruits now that he's running more and more national touring events. But it's not Toyota. Toyota has poured tons of money into driver development. But at the same time, they don't have all the seats to put them into. So that's kind of where I feel like Chevy sits back and says, okay, we're going to let Toyota develop them, and then we're going to cherry pick them because they don't have enough seats to put them all in. And Ford is just kind of quietly doing their thing. But Chase Briscoe is a wheel dude and can drive just about anything and drive it fast. So I feel like as he gets another couple years under his belt, you're going to see him at the top level, and you'll see him be another one of these guys we watch on Sundays winning races, which the more I'm around this thing, you can feel like the sport is in trouble for many management-type decisions that the sanctioning body runs, but it is not in trouble from a talent standpoint. There is a plethora of very talented young drivers that are either in Cup or about to be in Cup that should be around for the better part of 20 years before we have another turnover again. So I'm excited about it. I think Chase is one of those guys that is doing it the right way, and he's working his way up slowly. He's not being thrown into it. And I think in the end that's going to pay big dividends for Ford and for Chase.
So I'm pretty outspoken when it comes to the Chase Briscoe deal because I feel like, you know, it seems like he's been around for a while because he dominated ARCA in 2016 with Cunningham, won the championship. 2017 went to Trucks and ran decent with Brad, didn't get a win until the last race at Homestead. 2018 only ran a partial schedule with Roush Fenway and Stuart Haas at the Xfinity, and that was all Ford. Ford backed him entirely. Briscoe's talked on the podcast about this last year. And also he talked to me about a feature I wrote on him last year, just about how much Ford has backed him and how... So I recommend listening to the Michael Waltrip podcast this week. I listened to it this morning. It came out Wednesday. Chase Briscoe's the guest. And it all stemmed from a deal that happened with Roush Fenway where Christopher Bell was actually supposed to run... he got asked to run for Roush Fenway years back in a developmental deal, and he turned it down. Chase Briscoe, who was living with Bell at the time... And one of, I feel like it was someone that worked for Cunningham. I can't remember the guy's name. They were both living with him. He was a big sprint car guy back in the day. So Briscoe's like, all right, I'm going to take the opportunity. So it led to this deal, and that was years back when he was in ARCA. So to see it kind of transpire now up to Xfinity and him being successful with Stuart Haas, he's running for his childhood hero in Tony Stewart, who we'll get to in a minute. But... Man, Chase, he's only got like 80 pavement starts. And he was really good on dirt. He started, I think, at 13, he said, in the podcast that I listened to with Michael Waltrip. Really good podcast. Chase is an underrated personality in NASCAR. And he's only 24 years old. So he's going to be around for a while, like you said, Neff. And we got a lot of good talent coming up through the rung of NASCAR, the bottom levels. Yeah, he's going to be around for a while. So to see him finally break through, because people are trying to compare him to Cole Custer. And you just can't do that yet, in my opinion, because look where Cole was 2 years ago in his rookie year in Xfinity. He didn't get a win until the, last race of the year at Homestead, which he dominated. So I think Chase is right on track.
I do, too. I think he's going to be a star in the sport. And I'm excited about the future of NASCAR from a driver talent standpoint.
Yeah, I agree. You got a lot of good guys in Xfinity, a lot of young guys. So, all right. So I brought up the Tony Stewart deal, Neff. I guess before we get to that, Tyler Reddick. So he finished fifth, but Richard Childress came out this week and said that Reddick's going to be in a Cup car in 2020, but they don't know if it'll be for them. But Reddick, you know, essentially a third full-time year in Xfinity would be a wasted year, kind of like it would be for Bell. Because Reddick won the championship last year, after all. Some people seem to forget that, but he did, and he's very consistent this year, leading the points. So, what's your take on that? Because we've seen RCR run as many as four cars in the past. Just last year, they ran three, or 2 years ago. 2 years ago, they ran three. I mean, obviously, you need sponsorship to do this deal, but Reddick's definitely ready, as we've talked about a lot on this podcast.
Yeah, it's one of those deals that he's ready, but where do we put him type thing? And, I mean, I get frustrated with this from the perspective of sponsors forcing owners' hands. And I'd like to see owners be the ones that make the decisions on their organizations, but unfortunately that's not the way the sport works these days. And we saw Daniel Suarez... whether Carl really retired on his own or not, get moved up faster than he probably should have, in my opinion. And were looking at that with Christopher Bell and talking about Erik Jones maybe being out of a job because Bell's ready to go to Cup, but where do you put him? So I especially worry about it from the Childress standpoint because, I mean, I can't remember the last time they've had a stable number of the same cars for 4 years in a row.
Right.
It's like every year they either add or subtract Xfinity cars or Cup cars.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not as easy as just saying, hey, we're going to run a third Cup car. There's jobs and there's infrastructure and there's haulers and there's inventory and there's so many different things that wrap around that. And you deal with payroll and employees and it's tougher on them because they're in Welcome. They're not in Mooresville where everybody else is. They're an hour up the road. And I had Justin Alexander was one of my Tech Talk guys last year. And he lived in Mooresville and made that drive every day from Mooresville to Welcome. And it's an hour drive. And as when I used to do my Tech Talk with him, I used to do it while he was driving home from the race shop because he had an hour to kill. And so it's a different animal getting people up there, and there's just so much that goes into ramping up to carry another team. And I worry that if you're getting pressure from a sponsor, is that sponsor going to give you enough backing to ramp all of that up, or do you end up trying to do it with partial sponsor money and then cutting corners and it ends up impacting your entire organization? Because anytime, at least that I can remember, seeing RCR increase number of cars has had a negative impact on their performance for at least a year, if not two. And I worry that if they try to go back to three Cup cars again, it may have a negative impact on Hemric and Dillon. And I don't know if they're ready to go through that again.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from. But then I also look at the aspect of RCR has had speed this year. I talked to Austin Dillon this weekend about it. They've had a lot of speed this year, especially in qualifying. But the cars are so trimmed out that they're out of control in the race and they fall backwards. So Austin Dillon's had a terrible past 2 months. And he'd admit it. Like in the past 2 months, he feels like he's wrecked more than he has in his Cup career ever. So because he's had like five finishes outside the top 32 in the past eight races or something like that. I just did that off the top of my head. But since the 600, it's been really bad for the three team. You know, we saw Hemric get a top 10 this weekend, only a second of the year, first on a non-super speedway. Talent-wise, Reddick's right there with him, if not above him, in my opinion. We've seen him have success at Xfinity, obviously. Hemric didn't. I mean, Hemric ran, he was top five. He top five-y to death. He points raced to death. But he never won. Same in the trucks. And we've seen Reddick win in anything and everything he gets in. But yes, this is a dollars and money sport. So again, like I said earlier in the podcast, I think the manufacturer is going to have the most say. Like we've talked about, you can't give up on Hemric because he's a very talented race car driver. But also you got Reddick, and he came to RCR. He left Junior Motorsports, came to RCR because he felt like it was the best opportunity for him to get in a good, decent equipment at the Cup level, because at the time and still to this day, Hendrick Motorsports has, I mean, they got three guys that are really young, and Jimmy Johnson's probably the GOAT. So, and you know, he might retire here in a year or two, but, you know, Reddick's in a good position, I feel like you're dead on when they've moved to three cars. They haven't always been the best. Just look at 2 years ago in Xfinity, they ran five full-time cars.
Yeah.
You had the three car, which had a lot of different drivers. But then you had Brendan Gaughan, Brandon Jones, Hemric, and I'm forgetting one. But they had five full-time cars. And that's kind of unheard of, for sure, especially at the Cup level. You can't have that now. So, yeah, very, very interesting situation with Reddick. And it was surprising to see Childress come out and kind of say that they don't know if he'll be back, only because it's a one-year deal at Xfinity. And it's ultimately going to come down to sponsorship. So that'll definitely be something to keep an eye on, because I thought for sure he'd move up for next year and it'd be with RCR. But now we're in August when this podcast comes out, August 1st. So I guess we'll have to wait and see, Neff.
Absolutely.
All right. One more topic before we go to predictions and from my side. Neff, a video circulated over the weekend of Tony Stewart going after a fan at a dirt car track. Where was it? Jackson, you said?
Yes, Jackson Speedway.
Got it. Yeah. So ultimately, from what the video showed, and I only saw a 25-second video, Tony was getting heckled, and I saw this from reports too. Tony was getting heckled by fans. Someone gave him a finger. This video starts that I saw with him, Tony also, you know, giving the finger back to the guy. And then the fan, if you'd even call him a fan, you know, Tony, I got two of these. And he shows up his middle fingers. And then he, you know, Tony runs after the guy. And he definitely made contact because he either punched or slapped or whiffed. He did something to the guy. But what's your thoughts on this? Because obviously we're going to Eldora, which Tony owns, and Watkins Glen's this weekend, which is not far from Canandaigua. I mean, it's just a bad week, I feel like, for this to happen.
I mean, it just, there's good and bad aspects to it. I mean, we talk about, we like to see the passion from the drivers. We talk about them settling their differences between them and not with cars. I liked that it was just the two of them and you didn't have the whole cruise or whatever jumping in. I don't know what that other guy's role was. I kind of felt like he was just a rogue person. I don't feel like he was part of a team or there with other people. It seemed like he was kind of on his own. So, I mean, you don't want to see Tony do that, but at the same time, that's part of why we love Tony. I mean, what was it, 2 years ago at the Chili Bowl, he went in the stands and chewed a guy out because the guy was yelling at him while he was out there prepping the track. I mean, it's... Stewart is passionate, and he won't back down, and that's what made him a great driver, and that's what's made Eldora into the Eldora that it is now. Eldora was a good track. They have made it into a showcase facility.
Right.
And it is second to none at this point in the dirt track world, and it's because of the passion and the drive of Tony and Roger Slack and their whole crowd up there. But timing's bad. I don't know if it's ever good timing to have a team owner, track owner in NASCAR slapping people in the head. But it seems like it was over and done with pretty quickly. I didn't hear of any charges being filed. I think everybody handled it like adults, if slapping somebody is like an adult. In the end, I think it was kind of enjoyable from a perspective of it showed passion and enjoyable when it didn't come down to lawsuits. Now, mind you, there's always statutes of limitations, and this guy could get a wild hair when he realizes he may get a big payday. But right now, I think it was just at the end of a night of racing, and you're hot in the middle of the summer running in the Midwest, and tempers got a little carried away, so... Yeah, probably not the best thing for him to do, but I don't think it was terrible.
Yeah, I'm pretty fair with your points too. I agree with them primarily. I don't think it's a good look for NASCAR per se, only because Tony is one of the youngest team owners at 48 years old, and he's going to be around for a while. We would imagine at owning a Cup team, or at least co-owning a Cup team with Gene Haas. So I feel like from that aspect, it's not good. From the aspect of owning a track, which we're going to this week in the truck series, it's not good. so the timing probably wasn't great.
He also owned the series that was...
That's true.
...the series racing where he got the fight.
That's true, yeah. I don't know. It's Tony being Tony. That's all I can say. And
yep.
Like you said, we love...
Stewart doing Stewart
things. We love Tony for who he is, and that's the way he's always been. He's always been like a ball of fire. Don't piss him off. So... I really don't have a problem with it, only maybe just the timing aspect. But Neff, any final thoughts before we get to predictions here?
Only other thought I have is we talked about Stewart. We saw the same thing coming out of Bowman Gray Stadium again.
Oh, my God.
Two guys trying to kill each other.
Literally.
You get fans that say that's not what they want to see, but that's what they want to see. That's why 10,000 to 15,000 people show up every Saturday night all summer long at Bowman Gray Stadium, and they don't show up at every other racetrack in the country because that's what you get at Bowman Gray. And I hate to see guys using cars as weapons, but again, once they started to get out of the cars, I wish they'd have let them beat the crap out of each other so they got it out of their system, because I feel like both of them are dumb enough to do this again before the season ends. And I just, it's been a rough year at Bowman Gray so far this year. Hopefully we can finish it out here in the next couple of weeks without any more stupidity.
Yeah, I saw the videos from that, and that was crazy.
Bowman Gray.
Yeah, I agree, but it's also like, you know, on video games and NASCAR, like back in the day, even today, if you have cautions off, you can just go and go the wrong way on the track. And that's essentially what this was. It was crazy. Yeah. And then he took the dude out, and it happened two different times, right? Or was it just one?
I only saw the video of the one. I mean, I know there was...
I think I saw...
There's been a couple wrecks there in the last couple weeks that all kind of has run together. Plus, we got the people fighting in the pits, filing charges against each other and stuff, so who knows?
Yeah, I think I saw two different videos of the same crash from two different aspects, but that was wild. Something you rarely ever see in any kind of form of racing. So, Bowman Gray. Neff, now, as I've mentioned, you know, we have two different venues this week. We have Eldora for the trucks, the annual Dirt Derby, and then we got Watkins Glen, which I'm very biased, and it's home for me, so I'm very excited to be out there. But we'll start with Eldora. Who you got winning the truck race?
I hinted at it earlier. I'm going to Friesen. Friesen is so due for a win, and I feel like this is his time to finally knock this damn win off at his place or his forte.
Playground.
I'm going to pick a dark horse of Kyle Strickler for a couple reasons. Although Strickler didn't do that well in the truck last year, he and Nick Hoffman were actually teammates, and Strickler didn't do as well as Nick did in the race, although he was still in the running. But he went over there to the Dream this year, first time ever in a dirt late model, and led like half the race. I mean, it was ridiculous how fast he was. And so I feel like he's figuring some stuff out in these full-size type cars at Eldora, and I would not be surprised to see Kyle Strickler. I don't know if he's going to win, but I think he's going to be up in the mix for sure.
Yeah, kind of like the Bobby Pierce deal from a few years ago.
I felt bad about that. Bobby Pierce is not running it this year. Whenever he ran it, it was always with Mike Mittler. And sadly, we lost Mike to cancer this year. And so Bobby, he had some stuff in the works with Mike's team, but when Mike passed on, it kind of fell apart. And so he's not running it this year. And it makes me sad. I mean, I'm already sad that we lost Mike because he was a great guy. But to see that a guy that very well could have won this race a couple times is not going to have a shot this year because of it makes me sad, too.
Agreed. But I do feel like there are going to be a lot of guys that have a shot because there are a lot of dirt guys racing it. And I kind of tooted his horn earlier, but I'm going Briscoe. He's running a one-off for ThorSport in the 27. They've been working on this all year long. So since he ran the race last year when he was running only a partial schedule in Xfinity, they got a sponsor in Di-Edge. I think they're going to run very well. There's never been a driver to repeat, and no driver's won two races at Eldora at the truck level. And this is what, its seventh year or something like that, seventh or eighth year. So I think Bristol's going to be the first one to go, not just repeat, but just a two-time winner at the track. And like I said earlier, he's got a dirt background, so it wouldn't surprise me at all. Neff, we're going to Watkins Glen. The Xfinity Series has three road courses this month, three out of the four races, so we'll be talking about left and rights here on the podcast in the coming month. But who you got winning the Xfinity race? It's a stacked lineup. We got Kyle Busch making his return after 4 months off. Ryan Blaney's making his first start of the year. And then you got A.J. Allmendinger and Ryan Preece also running.
First of all, hashtag run the boot. don't understand why we don't run the boot. I understood it when you had four guys in NASCAR that could win on road courses. Now that everybody has the talent, run the damn boot. No reason not to. I could take the easy way out and take Kyle Busch, because I'm pretty sure Kyle Busch will win this race.
I do too.
But since we don't want to take the cheesy, easy way out, let's get crazy with the cheese whiz and say Noah Gregson, after almost winning in the trucks in Canada on a road course. I think he could pull this one off.
Well, you left me Allmendinger, so I'm going to go Allmendinger. He almost won at Daytona. Obviously, the car got, foul tech, so he ended up finishing last. But he's a great road racer. We've seen him beat Kyle Busch, Juan Pablo Montoya, Marcos Ambrose at Watkins Glen in 2014. I feel like he's going to be the guy. And last year, he ran for GMS in the Xfinity race. And when it was raining, because it did rain last year for like 10 laps, and that was an entertaining 10 laps, because you had, once the track started to dry, those tires fell off real fast. They started to burn the rubber. So, hoping there's no rain, but I do think Allmendinger is going to get Colleague Racing its second career win. But I'm only saying that because I really don't want to see Kyle win, because I feel like he's going to win.
For Death Wish Coffee.
Yeah,
I think we should get some marketing out of that. I think the merchandise sales will be off the chain if Allmendinger wins in the Death Wish Coffee car.
Yeah, so that's a coffee company out of Albany. They sponsored Daniel Hemric in 2017 for a few races, including Watkins Glen. I interviewed Hemric in 2017 at the Glen, and I don't like coffee, so I gave it to my mother, and she said she loved the coffee. So Death Wish Coffee, we're here if you want to sponsor us. Now, moving on to the Cup Series, Neff, like you said, a lot of guys have improved on their course, road course ability over the past, 10 years or so, and we got a lot of newer guys, like Chase Elliott last year winning, that can win at the on-road courses. So, who you got?
Okay, since we're in a Cup Series, I'm taking Kyle Busch. I'm not going to take him at the lower series because I think that's cheating, but he's just that good, and unless something stupid happens, he's going to be in the mix, and then we'll see what happens from there. But of everybody that's running it, I think he's got to be the odds-on favorite.
I think he's the second favorite. I think Truex is the favorite.
Truex has been hot on road courses for the last couple of years.
And I'm going with Truex to win. I picked him at Sonoma. He won at Sonoma. Should have won the Roval last year. Was second on the final lap, battling with Chase at Watkins Glen. He could have won that had he not run out of fuel. We don't know what would have happened because Chase overran turn one. Won at Sonoma in 2018, so there's two out of the last four. And then he won at Watkins Glen in 2017. So he's won three out of the last five road courses. Could have won all five because he got dumped on the Roval by Jimmy Johnson on the last corner. So I feel like Truex is the odds-on favorite. I think Kyle will be right there. I feel like... Brad Keselowski's used to run good at Watkins Glen, not so much anymore, but I feel like you're going to have like Harvick up front. You're going to have the usuals. I think Chase will be good, which Chase needs a good finish. Seven straight finish.
I think you'll have Boyer in the mix, too.
I do, too. And then maybe like a Ryan Blaney. He almost won this race 2 years ago, bad to pit late for fuel. So I think it's going to be an entertaining race. We love road course racing. I love road course racing. And this is my home, pretty much. This will be my 20th straight year going to Watkins Glen. So,
the one thing I hope they do next year is change the way the end of the stages are handled on road courses. Because I just feel like stage finishes at road courses takes almost all the strategy out of the race.
I agree. Everyone, for the most part, pits.
You basically get two options. You either pit before the end of the stage or you pit at the end of the stage.
Right.
And if they did it to where they do something where they just keep going and they just score the points as they have it, but they don't throw the caution, I think it would be a lot better idea on road course.
I think that would work there and also at Pocono. But Pocono, it had a good, as we talked about, good strategy this past weekend. Fun strategy, I should say. Now, if we got Alex Bowman coming up, up on the podcast. I talked to him at Pocono. We chatted about everything from his dogs, which you and I spoke about offline, about some fun topics for Alex, but also his win last month at Chicago, which we're now a month out from, and also how 2019's going, because I said last week on the podcast that he's a sneaky pick to get to Homestead right now. I know the last month or so haven't gone as planned, but what's your take on Alex this year and that 88 team?
I mean, Alex has finally won, so that was a good thing. I feel like he's at home or at peace. I felt like when he was in the underfunded cars, he got kind of defeated, and I don't know that necessarily started doubting his own talent, but just almost didn't push himself because he felt like he had no equipment there to do it with. And now that he's at the top level with the top team, he knows he's got to push it himself, and it's making him a little bit better driver. And I don't know that he's ever going to be a superstar, but I think he's a good enough driver to win races, and we've seen him finally win one. I think there are more coming. And I also think he's just a genuine good dude. Have known him for a long time, and he's always been super nice to the front stretch and super nice to me in person. And that's rare in these modern days of racing world. So I appreciate that very much, and I hope that he has several years ahead of him at Hendrick winning some races.
Yeah, that was definitely a fun interview. So let's get to my conversation with Alex Bowman. Now, this year you got the win in Chicago, obviously. 3 second-place finishes, a couple other top tens. How did you gauge the season as a whole?
A lot of ups and downs. I wish we were a little more consistent than we have been. You know, we had a little stretch there where we had some consistency, but not enough by any means. So, you know, it's been good. Obviously, getting a win was really good for us, but we probably gave one away in Kansas and could have had a couple by now. So we just got to keep working really hard. We're able to try some things before the playoffs start, like we are this weekend. And obviously, what we're trying is not working so far, but hopefully we can hit on some things and be really good in the playoffs.
But compared to the first 9 races, the last 11 have been a lot better with the win. So what do you feel like has led to the turnaround?
I don't know. I feel like it's hard to say they've been better. The last 3 have been rough. So it's like you quickly forget about how good it was right before that. But I don't know. We kind of just got a little bit off base in the start of the year. We really struggled. We stopped doing our own thing and kind of were just trying too hard, more focused on what other people were doing. And we kind of said screw it and kind of went back to doing our own thing. And had a lot of success with that.
Now, when you're inconsistent, I mean, what's that do to the team's mentality, your mentality?
It's definitely frustrating. You know, I think we expected to show up here with a lot of speed and be really good. And obviously we didn't. So that's frustrating. You know, I think we've had our share of ups and downs, and last week was a big down for us on Saturday, but the team really stuck together and did a good job of fighting through that, working really hard, and they really worked really well together. So that was impressive to see. I think today's been equally as frustrating, just in the fact that literally every change we made didn't affect the race car. So I know Greg's frustrated, and that just wears on guys, but you know, we've definitely got fast race cars. We were just struggling here lately.
But kind of off that, the last time I talked to you in depth was at Dover, and that was right before you got the second place finish in a row. So what do you feel like is the biggest thing that you and Greg, the 88 team, has improved on over the last 3 months or so?
Just staying confident in ourselves. You know, I think it's easy to get down on yourself in this sport, and it's easy for Greg to get frustrated and me to get frustrated, but it's like on a day like today where everything you're doing's not working, we won 3 weeks ago, so it's not the end of the world. You know, we know we can go do it. We just we got to figure out what works for us.
Now, speaking of the win, like you said, 3 weeks ago, how validating was that for you?
Yeah, it was really good. I was really glad to kind of get that out of the way and finally get one. So we want to get a whole bunch more and keep running up front, but it was definitely good.
Besides, I'm sure it gave you some sort of confidence, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I was pretty confident throughout, you know, that stretch of races anyway. We were really, really good and had a lot of really fast race cars, so that helps. But I definitely felt like I gave a couple away, so finally getting one and winning, especially the way we did racing with Kyle there, was definitely a confidence booster.
So you brought up last week, of course, that was New Hampshire when the drive shaft exploded pretty much, and then the practice crash. But you finished 14th in a third car, so is that kind of a morale boost as a team?
Yes and no. I think it created a lot of work. I was pretty embarrassed. You know, the guys worked way harder than they should have had to, so that was frustrating for me to feel like I caused that, but it is what it is. That stuff's going to happen in the sport, and it's not the first time it's happened, and it won't be the last time.
Now, this is your second full year working with Greg. How do you feel like the chemistry and the relationship's kind of evolved over the past year and a half?
Yeah, I think it's been really good. You know, especially lately, we seem to be on the same page and kind of know what we're looking for out of each other. So I think that's been really good. It's tough, you know. This sport can be frustrating on days like today and last week, but you know, he's made some really good pit strategy calls all year that have really helped us out, and you know, I think he does a great job on and off the box.
So I feel like I know what the answer is going to be, but leading into the playoffs, what's one thing you want to work on as a team?
I think consistency is the biggest thing. You know, but I think there's a lot of really good racetracks for us. I can't wait to get to Las Vegas. We're going to be, as long as nothing changes and our mile and a half program stays how it's been, I think we're going to be super good at Vegas. So I'm really excited to get there. But the whole list of playoff races, I think, can be really good for us.
Yeah, how do you feel like the playoffs do line? Because last year you got to the round of 12, but this year you got the win. Even though you say you're inconsistent, it seems like you're a little more consistent than last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think each round has tracks that are really good for us. Obviously, we go to Dover and Kansas again, so those will be good. We ran good at the Roval last year. It's kind of everywhere we go throughout the playoffs, we're pretty strong. So I'm looking forward to it. It's a good list of tracks.
What's the biggest thing you learned from last year's playoff, being your first time making the postseason?
I don't know. I don't know that there is much to learn about how the playoffs work. It's really, you don't do anything different as far as how you go out and race. You know, you want to do the best you can every week and maximize everything every week. You might take some gambles for stage points and trade off some finishing position and stuff like that throughout the playoffs to try to boost yourself in points. But other than that, I mean, it's still just digging as much as you can every race.
I said on my podcast this week, I thought you were a sneaky pick to get to Homestead. Do you kind of feel that way?
That'd be nice. Yeah, I think it's definitely possible. You know, if we get hot again, kind of like we did a month or so ago, you know, I think for sure it's something we can do. We're definitely capable of doing it. We just have to do the right things and run our races the right ways.
A couple fun ones, Dan. How much you miss dirt racing?
Well, I wasn't ever really like a huge dirt guy. I ran a little bit of dirt. I ran midget. Everybody thinks I ran dirt because I raced midgets all the time, but I ran pavement midgets, so at least more than I ran dirt midgets. But I miss it. I enjoy going back and running Chili Bowl through the winter. That's always a good time. I really enjoy working on those cars and building them more than driving them, almost. Just Chili Bowl, there's no rule book, so you can kind of do whatever you want. I enjoy that side of it.
Now, on Instagram, I see you've been posting a lot about your dogs, Roscoe and Finn, right?
Yep.
So, in my world, like, dogs are my best friend.
Yep.
Is that the case for you?
100%, for sure. They're probably my best and only friends.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah, for sure. They're great to come home to. This week, they tore some stuff up, but you'll have that, I guess.
What happens when they tear some stuff up?
Well, they're really good, and they just roam the house, and it's like once a month they just pick something and destroy it. So this month it was a book. It was actually that book, The Art of Racing in the Rain, so it's got to do with a dog, and they tore it up, so a little ironic, but they did it an hour ago, right, by the time you got home, so you point at it and say, what is this, and they put their tail between their legs and walk away, and it is what it is.
All right, y'all. So there you have it. Fun conversation there with Alex Bowman, who's had a lot to battle since winning his race at Chicago about a month ago now, but I truly believe, like I said to him and to Neff, that the 88 team could be sneaky come the playoff time, potentially making it to the Final Four at Homestead Miami Speedway. Always enjoy chatting with Neff, especially because obviously we're both pretty passionate about racing and how much we want the product to produce on the track. I thought this was definitely a step in the right direction when it comes to Pocono, way better than the June race, and I'm really looking forward to next year's doubleheader weekend. But that's it for this week's show. As I mentioned earlier, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. But until next week's show, and I know it'll be a good one when we review Watkins Glen, we out.